Hey, my name is Valerie, and I am an alcoholic.
Well, you aren't kidding. It is short and to the point.
I turned around. Billy goes, if you haven't prayed, you better pray now, because we don't do a lot of readings, in case you're planning on praying during the readings. And I was like, wow, he needs Al-Anon. He's like directing me. And then my first thought was, well, I had two thoughts. And as an alcoholic, I can think multiple things at one time. And but my first thought is, no, I'm going to be a heathen speaker. I ain't praying for nothing. And then my second thought was, wow, I was up in Pennsylvania last weekend. And I heard a great Al-Anon joke, so I'm going to share that with y'all. What is the last thing an Al-Anon sees before they die? Anybody? Anybody? Another person's life flashes before their eyes. I thought that was an awesome joke. I thought it was great. So, anyway, my name is Valerie Downing, and I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Jaywalkers group in Richmond, Virginia. We meet on Tuesdays and Fridays, so if you're ever in Richmond on Tuesday or Friday and you have nothing better to do, come see us. My sobriety date's October 13th, 1992. I have a sponsor, talk to him on Thursday, and I sponsor women when asked. And what else can you say beyond that? I guess I'm supposed to tell you, well, thank you, Billy, for asking me to come out and talk. I always enjoy the drive out here. It's a beautiful, beautiful drive. And I love it when you guys come out to Richmond to talk. Some of y'all have been out there, and it's always a night. It's a commitment to come, you know what I mean? So it's always nice when people say yes. But it was nice to get out of my house, because I've got a 1-year-old, and I couldn't wait to get out of the house. So, and you know, smoke lots of cigarettes and listen to music really loud, because I can't do any of that when he's in the car, you know. So it was really nice for me. And I'm going to enjoy it the whole way back too. But that's been a new experience for me. I also have a 20-year-old, and it wasn't on my agenda to get pregnant and have a child at 43 years old, but there you have it. He's here. So, you know, it's been a huge gift, but at the time it was really overwhelming and lots of prayer involved about, oh God, what do I do now? So prayer does work, because I managed to have that thing, and I haven't killed my husband. I mean, this is good, and have stayed sober, because it has certainly been a challenging year with that. Anyway, I guess I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what's going on in my life today. I can also tell you, too, this week, God's timing is always perfect, and God really knew what was coming down the pike for me, I guess, because I was scheduled to be here tonight, and I have to be somewhere tomorrow night, and I'm coming off of a week of just being depressed, and I can't tell you why. I have no idea why. It just kind of showed up out of the blue, and I'm the kind of alcoholic who errs on the depressive side, I guess. I've always been that way ever since I was little. I guess some of it you could say is situational, and maybe some of it was. I do know that since I've been on a spiritual path, it's gotten better and better and better. I suffer with that less and less. But this week it just kind of showed up out of the blue, and my natural response is to fix it right away. And so I start trying to figure it out, what's going on, why, because I'm going to fix it, and something's wrong, so I need to fix it. And nothing's wrong, there's nothing going on, it just showed up. And I tell you, Bill Wilson talked about struggling with depression, and that the answer is turning outward, and which, when I'm depressed, is the last thing in the world that I want to do. I do not want to keep my commitments. I want to hole up in my house. I don't want to answer my phone. I don't want to go to work. Everything seems like it's a chore. But, you know, I've been suiting up and showing up anyway, because I know it'll pass. And I tell you, one of the women I sponsor, her husband took his own life. And I tell you, that would jerk your head right out of your ass right there. And while it's a horrible thing that happened, it's been great for me because I couldn't stay consumed with myself, which is what happens when I feel bad. I start getting consumed with myself. Force me to turn outward. Being here tonight forced me to turn outward. So it's a good thing. This stuff works, and it's amazing. I mean, if I could do it, shoot, I'd sleep till 11 o'clock every day, and, you know, and not get up, not go to work, but be the worst thing in the world for me. I'd be in bad shape pretty quick. So anyway, I started drinking, 14-ish, or that was when I had my first real drunk, was when I was 14, was on rum and coke. I'll never forget it. I loved it. I got really, really sick. I got into a lot of trouble. I didn't care. What happened to me when I drank changed me so much that I absolutely couldn't wait to do it again. I was the kind of kid who walked around very afraid of people, very turned inward. I felt very awkward, and I was awkward and very strange, and I was strange. Nobody really understood what was wrong with me. I didn't even understand what was wrong with me. I just felt very different from everybody else. And, you know, and I hear a lot of alcoholics describe that in different ways. Some people didn't go through it. Some people did. I was one of the people that did. And so when I got drunk, I just felt better. All that big hole in my gut was gone. I was not afraid. I really felt it. Our book describes it as I felt at perfect ease. I was finally comfortable with myself and comfortable with you. And I just started drinking like crazy. I wanted to feel that way 24/7. And if I could have gotten away with it, I would have. But as a 14-year-old, it's kind of tough. But I started doing a lot of things that, in order to drink, pretty quickly. I didn't progress. I am not one of those people that progressed into alcoholism over a long period of time. I was in a lot of trouble and in bad shape just within a year of drinking. But I pursued drinking as much and as often as I could. I used to sneak into people's houses and steal their booze. I would run around neighborhoods looking for doggy doors, and that's how I get in your house, is through the doggy door. And I'd steal your booze and snoop around your house and move stuff around, because I also like to mess with your mind. And I thought it was real cute. But I would do stuff like that. You know, I'd steal my parents' alcohol and water it down. I'd steal my friends' parents' alcohol and water it down. Just, you know, you do whatever you can. You can't buy it legal, so you do what you got to do to get it. So that's what I did. I got into a lot of trouble as of consequences for my drinking. And just within that period of a year, I was labeled an ungovernable by the state of Florida, habitual truant, habitual runaway, because literally getting booze and drinking came before everything else. When it talks about in the doctor's opinion about some deal that's going to be settled favorably for somebody if they do what they're supposed to do, but they take a drink and then all bets are off, that's me. I had intentions of going to school, but I took a drink. Or I had intentions of going back to school after lunch, but I took a drink. So, you know, things were not going favorably for me. However, I did not think that alcohol was the problem at all. I really believed that if my family was different, if they had nurtured me more, because I was definitely a delicate flower, if they had nurtured me more, then I would not be in the shape that I was in, that it was their fault. You know, my mom was married to an alcoholic, then she married a pilot in the Navy, and he was a real jackass, and they moved us around, and he was mean, and my mom was unavailable. And then I started going to therapy, and therapy just reemphasized all of that for me. I loved going to therapy, by the way. It was so much fun. And then one therapist that I ended up with had a little cocaine problem. So, you know, all the kids would get together. I mean, all, you know, we did the kid group therapy. And all the kids would get together and we'd try to steal his stash. And because he was tooting it up in his office, we found out from one of the other kids who walked in on him accidentally. So we tried to find his little stash, but we didn't know that it was, you know, in a little vial in his pocket. So, but anyway, we get together and smoke pot and go to therapy. It was great. And I don't know what happens to you if there's anybody in here who smoked weed. But, I mean, when I did it, I turned into like a little junior Freud and just diagnosed the world. But anyway, so I loved therapy. Therapy was fun to me. I also loved being hospitalized. I would intentionally try to go into the hospital because it was a break. It was a break from the world. I liked it. I really did. Sometimes I would intentionally try to make myself sick so that I could get so sick that I'd have to be hospitalized. Just weird stuff like that because I couldn't deal. Could not deal with life at all. At that young, I couldn't deal with it. It was just too much for me. So I went to go see a new therapist, and that therapist told my parents I had an alcohol and drug problem, and I needed to be put in a treatment center. So this was in 1982, and I got put in a treatment center. I was 15 years old. I was in there for 3 months. That's when treatment centers were nice. That's when insurance was good on the treatment center front. I mean, late 70s, 80s, early 90s, I mean, you could go to some nice treatment centers for 3 months and insurance would cover it all. You know, ones with pools and whirlpools and craft shop and tennis courts and hiking trails and nice rooms. And you only had to share it with one other person. I mean, it was sweet. So I enjoyed being in treatment. It was a comfortable place. But when I went there, I did not think I was an alcoholic. And they told me that I was. I did not think that I had a problem with alcohol at all. I thought it was funny that I was there. I was a little scared when I was dropped off, but I adjusted to my new environment quickly. I had people sneak some alcohol and drugs in there. I snuck out to get beer. I dropped acid in treatment. I mean, I also did that before I went to court. I mean, I was just insane. And not the best way to show up for the doctor or for the judge. You know what I mean? But I mean, to me, everybody needs to get off my back. You need to leave me alone. I'm fine. Leave me alone. If you would just leave me alone, I'll get it together. But y'all keep bugging me and harassing me. And just let me do what I got to do. And so I wasn't a good treatment center participant. The only good thing that happened to me there was that I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got out of treatment, I started going to AA meetings. My mother used to drop me off at the A&A. I hated it. I was humiliated. I was embarrassed. And back then in that area of Florida, there were not a lot of young people there. So I went into this old rickety building in Orange Park, Florida. And it's when you could still smoke in meetings. So, you know, it had the tile ceilings, and there's like the 6-foot cloud of smoke hanging from the ceiling. There's ashtrays everywhere. There's a bunch of old men in the corner around that damn coffee pot. And I called them the crusty team. And I sat in the back and with my arms crossed and was just waiting for till I could get out of there. And my mom would come and pick me up. You know, some of the old guys started talking to me after I kept showing up for a little bit, and some of the things that they told me was that I was too young to be an alcoholic, that I still had time, that I needed to go home, be a good girl, go to church, do what my parents were asking me to do, go to school. I had so much potential, and I was wasting it, and I needed, you know, they were trying to straighten me out. And I got a little upset by that because I had to go to these AA meetings and I felt like, you know, I have to go. You don't even want me here. Fine, I'll prove to you I'm an alcoholic. So I stole the key to their little beloved clubhouse. That's where I take my friends to go drinking. I stole their money. I figured if they were dumb enough to not leave it secured, then they deserve to have it stolen. Because what they used to do is they'd pass the basket, then they'd put it in an envelope, and then they'd put it in the Coke machine. I mean, all you need is a good hanger, and you're in business. And you know, pretty soon, though, they started, you know, you need to sit down and be quiet, and you need to be here. You got a problem. And I will say, too, that, you know, I knew something was wrong. I've looked for answers in a lot of different places. I've been to church, different churches. I was raised Episcopalian. I've been confirmed. My parents sent me back to do it again. I've been confirmed twice because they didn't think I got it the first time. I have been to, you know, the Jimmy Swaggart altar call type thing, tent revival stuff, you know, healing hands, all that stuff. I've been saved numerous times. And, you know, that stuff, while it was very emotional for me, I would have an emotional experience. It's like our book talks about, it was fleeting and then soon lost. It did not solve my problem. Maybe if I could have hung in there with it, it would have, but I never could. And like when those guys were telling me, you know, go home, be a good girl, go to church, la 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 la, I couldn't do it. Lack of power was my dilemma. I couldn't pull that off, even though I wanted to pull it off. I could not do it. But anyway, so I ran in and out of AA like a crazy woman for about 2 years. When I was 17, I got into a lot of legal trouble and over drinking, of course, and stealing in order to do it. And I got caught. And the option was we're pressing felony charges and you're going back to juvie or you can get sober. And I decided to get sober. At that time, I was at a bottom as much as a 17-year-old can be at a bottom. I said, I'm going to get sober and I'm never going to drink again. And I meant it. I really did. When I look back, I mean, I remember it clearly. When I look back on it, I can remember how I thought, how I felt, what I was wearing. I remember making that decision that I'm going to stop drinking for good and for all. My father was now sober in Los Angeles and I decided I'm going to move out to LA and be with him because he'll understand because, you know, I got this thing from him anyway, so I'm going to head on out to Los Angeles and it's going to be different out there. And it wasn't any different. One of the things that my dad said to me before I came out there was that I had to work, all 9 steps. And I was like, okay. I didn't know what that meant, so I whipped out the handy 12 and 12. And what I would do is I'd read a step, and I'd call them up, and I'd report in on what I found. And I'd wait a respectable amount of time. I'd read up on the next step. I'd call them and tell them that. And it was all a lie. I had no idea what I was doing. I did not have a sponsor. I had no idea what was going on. I was just lying my way out of there because I need out of here. And I need to be out there with you. It's going to be different out there. So I had dropped out of high school. I went out there. He told me later, he knew the second I got off the plane that I hadn't done any of that work. And I believe that. At the time, I didn't believe it. I thought the old man was crazy. And then, of course, I had to, you know, get the lies rolling and explain myself. We're excellent liars. I mean, we're really good. But it's true. In being around AA this time and having gone through the steps and watching other people go through the steps who really do it, we are changed. We walk different, talk different. The stuff that's coming out of our mouth is different. The actions we're taking are different. I mean, we're completely different people. We're absolutely changed by the process. So now I get it. I understand exactly what he saw. Just a lion sick kid. And But I did start going to meetings every day. We used to go to this place in Covina, California called the 502 Club. At the time, it was the sobriety capital of the world. And I love that place. There's a lot of young people running around there. The saying, there used to be who's on who at the 502. I loved it. I mean, and you're young. You're a walking hormone, you know. There's lots of young boys running around, and I went to a meeting up there every day and hung out at the club. I didn't work. My dad was supporting me. The only reason I got a sponsor, and it was one that he picked for me, is because he wouldn't give me money if I didn't have one. So I got one, because I don't want to have to work, for God's sakes. You know what I mean? So I got one, and I would check in with her periodically. And bless her heart. Oh, and she was a therapist, too, which he... Golden! You know what I mean? I think that's why he picked her for me, too, is because he knew I needed a lot of help or something. But she was a good woman. Her name was Ruth, and I think she tried to help me the best I would let her. I would not let her into my life. I did not even grasp the idea of rigorous honesty. I couldn't even wrap my mind around that. I was such a liar about everything. Everything. So I couldn't have told her the truth anyway, I don't think. But I was sitting in a meeting of AA every day. And chasing boys, and we called them the 13-step dances, going to the dances all around Southern California and Hollywood, and chasing tail, and just acting like maniacs. I did not hang with the winners in AA. I didn't hang with the people that were serious about AA. You know, I would go to meetings, the kind that you could walk in late, leave early. Lots of crosstalk. Most of the meetings in California are podium meetings in Southern California, where I was at. All discussion meetings are from the podium, or most of them. And they clap after everybody speaks. But anyway, I'd go to the meetings where they allowed heckling. And, you know, they'd heckle the person who got up to share. And I loved it. I loved the drama and excitement of it. I mean, that was AA to me. And I thought I was doing AA. I really, really did. So anyway, I'm still very, very sick, though. I'm not drinking, but my alcoholism is progressing. And, you know, I really believe we have a spiritual malady. Because while I was sitting in that meeting every day, not treating my dryness. The ism piece of my alcoholism, whatever you want to call that or however you look at that. So that was not arrested, and that was not getting better. So I was still I was leading a life as if I was still drinking. I just wasn't drinking, and it was getting worse. Still lying, still stealing. I mean, I loved to steal. I still love it today. If I could get away with it and do it, I would. I mean, I love it. I don't know if anybody relates with that, but I love taking something that's not mine and getting away with it. You know what I mean? I still have a thought when I go into places. The only thing that stops me sometimes is that I know I'll have to go make amends, and I don't want to. Seriously, that's the only thing that stops me sometimes. It's sad, but that stuff still will go on in my head sometimes. But anyway, so I'm just getting very, very sick. Sit in a meeting every day, and eventually I drank again, and it happened very quickly. There was no effective mental defense against the first drink. Literally, somebody asked me, do you want a drink? I said yes. What's interesting, though, to me, when I look back on that, is that my mind immediately went into the lies of why it was okay, why it's different. You know, I was too young to be an alcoholic. Now I'm out and I'm living on my own, and I got this guy who's going to take care of me. So it's going to be different. I'm not under my parents' rule anymore. And I don't have to do anything to make them happy anymore. So it's going to be different. This guy's going to take care of me. I'm older now. I'm wiser now. I'll just keep praying. I didn't even know about the big book. Shoot, I was sober this time before I even realized that how it works was out of the big book. I had no clue. I knew the 12 and 12, and I knew Hazleton. That's all I knew. That's all I knew about AA. And at the time, too, because of treatment centers, that's all you were given, was the little black book, the 12 and 12, and Hazleton stuff. You know, I had a big book that I got, but I mean, my big book had the little, it was used as a coaster. I had, you know, the drink stains on it. I didn't know that our program was outlined in the big book. I had no idea. So I ended up drinking again. I stayed out for 4 years. I really wanted to have a good time drinking, and I really wanted to be able to do it. And for a little while, it seemed like I was getting away with it. We moved from Los Angeles, this guy and I, we moved from Los Angeles to Atlanta. We were living a little outside of Atlanta. We were living on 20 acres, and you know, something ain't right. I don't know what it is. I mean, I've got this guy, we're living in a nice house. We got, you know, got a pool, we got a barn, we got a pond, we got little fields. Thought this would make it better. I don't, something's not right. So I go to an AA meeting, and I'm very uncomfortable in that meeting. And after the meeting, I said to this woman, I said, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. She goes, why are you here? And I'm like, well, told her, you know, I just moved out here from Los Angeles. Thought I'd better check out a meeting. I started drinking, check out a meeting. And, you know, but I just don't know if I'm an alcoholic. And she said to me, well, you're here, aren't you? Well, that doesn't mean anything to me. I never went back. That's not what makes me alcoholic, because I show up at an AA meeting. I didn't understand what it meant at all to be an alcoholic. Nobody had ever explained it to me. I thought it was because of my consequences that that's what made me an alcoholic. That's why it was so easy for me to say, well, it's different now. You know, I'm not young and getting into trouble and running here and running there and blah, 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 blah. So I don't have those consequences anymore, so I must not be alcoholic. So I didn't know that's not what makes you one of us. And so that message had no depth and weight to me whatsoever. I left and never went back. And then I started the thing that we all do. I started trying to arrange my life and the people in it so that I could be comfortable in my own skin and be happy. And, you know, I started trying different things to see, is this it? Is this it? One of the things I tried was raising sheep. I thought if I became a sheep herder, that whole back to nature, shoveling sheep dew out in the barn thing, that's the answer. That's it. I'm going to be a sheep herder. And I believed this stuff. That's what's crazy. I mean, I really believed it. That hard work stuff, you know. Pretty soon I'm drunk with my sheep. I mean, raising sheep did not work. And I say this, and it's very true, because I thought about it while I was drunk with my sheep. But I'm like, thank God I'm not a man, because the sheep would be in trouble. Because I don't know what happens to you when you drink, but when I drink, it looks good. You know what I mean? So anything looks good. So raising sheep did not work. I thought if I go get a job, maybe I just got too much time on my hands. Maybe if I go get a job. That didn't work, because the kind of work I was attracted to was with people who partied, who stayed out all night, and that didn't work. And then I decided, well, I'm going to have a baby. That's the ticket. That's going to force me to grow up. That's going to force me to be responsible. It's going to force me to change and be a good person. So I got pregnant. That did not work. Having a baby did not work. Pretty soon I was drunk with my baby. Dropping my baby off, saying I'll be back, not coming back. driving with my baby drunk in the car, or driving with my baby downtown so I can buy some dope. Having a baby did not solve the problem. I figured if I'm important, maybe I need to hang around people that are really important. Then I'll try that. So I tried that. That didn't work either. It was just a mess. The last 2 years of my drinking, I was living up in New York, and in upstate New York. And God help us, we lived in front of a dairy farm. I didn't think anything about the cows like I did with the sheep, but there was a lot of farm hands running around. I do know that. And you know, pretty soon I'm running around with farm hands drinking. I'm riding on bikes, Harleys, drinking. I come in too with burns all over the sides of my legs, and showing up at or waking up at people's houses, and that's not where I started. And where's my kid? Because my husband traveled, and I mean, it was just it started to become terrifying. And I was just leading a really ugly life and doing a lot of really ugly things, and I guess we all do, at the expense of other people. You know, and I don't think that those were my intentions. I think I wanted to be a good person. But boy, when I start drinking, it's done. There's no stopping that. And I just can't predict on what's going to happen. And I don't want to hurt people, but that's what was happening. And so one night, my father called me. And I answered the phone. I pretty much tried to avoid his calls at all costs because I didn't want to hear that AA crap. And for whatever reason, I picked up the phone that night. And it had been a particularly humiliating evening. And usually I can brush that stuff off. But that night, I was fully aware of the disappointment from other people. And I was fully aware of how much I had humiliated myself with how I behaved. And I wasn't able to brush it off, drink it away, lie it away, or whatever. It was on me. And my dad called me that night, which God must have been involved with that. And I talked to him, and he basically 12-stepped me back into AA. I decided that when I moved down to Richmond, Virginia, we were getting ready to move down to Richmond, Virginia, I was going to get sober again. And I got down here and I started going to meetings. I went to, my first meeting was on a Monday night, the Phoenix Group off Huguenot Road in Richmond. When I went into that meeting, I felt like I was home. I knew I was in the right place. And when they read How It Works, I felt moved by that. And I can't really describe it. I knew I was in the right place. And I was kind of surprised with how I felt about that, too. I got a sponsor right away. The first woman I asked, she said no. The next woman I asked, she said yes. She ended up being committed shortly after that. But she was perfect for me for that period of time when I had her. She was crazy, and we understood each other. And because I was bouncing off the walls. I mean, alcohol takes the edge off. You know what I mean? When I'm sober, I am mean and angry. And there's just a tremendous amount of fear that I'm able to drink away. And when I don't have that anymore, it just comes out. I'm not a nice person on my own sober. So she helped me as much as she could. And, of course, she got committed and she couldn't help me anymore. I ended up getting this other woman who turned out not to be an alcoholic, but she tried to help me the best she could. She was in AA for about 4 years. She got into AA through some situational heavy drinking. She's a classic heavy drinker. I don't know if you've ever looked at the big book where it says the moderate drinker, which I know I'm not that. Then they had the heavy drinker and then the real alcoholic. She was a heavy drinker, but she was going through a really hard time in her life. She was doing some heavy drinking, and she had a suicide attempt. And so she got, you know, sent to AA. And she was in AA for about 4 years. She sponsored me for about a year. I didn't know she was an alcoholic. But anyway, she left. I saw her down the road a piece after I'd been sober a while. I ran into her at Greenfront, that furniture place out near Farmville. And her husband there, she's great. She's fine. Can drink was no problem. Her life is good. She's not one of us. And I guess the reason I'm telling you that is, you know, a lot of people show up in AA and they may or may not be an alcoholic. It's our job to help them find out. The first thing I got to do, though, is be clear on my own alcoholism. Am I really an alcoholic that like they describe in this book? Is that me? But Joanne helped me as much as she could. She took me through the 12 steps out of Hazleton. I left my husband. When I look back on that, I think I left him because of the overwhelming guilt that showed up once I sobered up of how I had behaved and what I had put him through. I couldn't handle it sober, and I didn't have any strong guidance or direction through the steps. The answer may have been the same. We may have ended up divorced. But I didn't have any strong direction or guidance, so I don't even know really what the truth about that is. I don't know if we could have worked it out if I was weller. I was doing a lot in AA like I was when I was sober before, going to meetings every day. I did have a sponsor, though, and was willing to do some stuff that I wasn't willing to do before. I was learning about how to be honest. I was trying to help other people. So I was making, it was a different experience for me, but I got to a point when I was about 3.5 years sober that I was losing my mind. And if something didn't change, I knew for a fact that I was going to take my own life or drink, one or the other. I mean, I knew it for a fact. I was just on the floor, suicidal depression. And Randy knew me during that period and saw me coming out of that. And we met this woman at the same time, I tell you, and she saved our life. You know, by a weird series of events, I got introduced to a woman who said, you know, I mean, she sounded like a bad Louisiana psychic, didn't she? You're going to die. You're going to die. Unless you get into all three parts of AA, you're going to die. Yeah. I know. You're going to die. I knew what she was saying was true because I wanted to die. I knew. And I, you know, I don't know. I can't speak for Randy, but I know for me, I fell in love with her because I heard her talk. And she talked about being 12 years sober and crazy, like I was crazy at the time, and angry, like I was angry at the time, and fearful, and just her life was a mess. And she had a shotgun. And she was with this guy who was a gambler and a drinker. And she got mad at him one night. And he went out and he was drinking and gambling. She got the shotgun and she was just sitting there waiting for him to come in. And she goes, I'm just waiting for him to come in so I could blow the old boy away. I mean, she shared that and I'm like, that's the woman for me. I love her. And I asked her immediately, will you help me? What was even more attractive to me, too, at that time was that the woman who was telling that story was not the same woman. She talked about the things that she had done and how she had been changed. And I could see it and I could feel it. So I asked her if she would help me. And she lived in Louisville, Kentucky, so it was a commitment to get help from this woman. If you have an out-of-town sponsor, man, no time for foo-fooing around, no time for dishonesty, no time for maybe I'll do this, maybe I won't, because it's really easy to hide out and, you know, play the game, which we all know how to do. So I was serious about her because I heard hope from her and I heard a real answer from her. She literally saved my life. I would not, or God used her, however you want to look at that, she saved my life. If it weren't for her, I would be dead or drunk. So anyway, I got together with her and started going through those steps, and As you know, she started at the very beginning of the book, which I had never done, our big book. And she said, Valerie, you know, wherever it says pray, we're going to pray. When it says write, we're going to write. When it says go here and do this, we're going to go there and do that. We're going to follow those directions. We're going to turn those statements into questions. And, you know, you're going to have to, you know, look at your beliefs about God. You're going to have to turn your life over. You're going to have to do this inventory, make these amends. And then you've got to go help other women. And are you willing to do this? And I said, yes, I was. I don't think she gave a crap what my answer was. She was not personally invested on whether I did it or not. She literally laid the kid at our feet and said, if you want it, come get it. But if you don't waste my time. See you later. Which was the best thing for me because I was so, I wouldn't have heard it any other way. She would yell at me, and she was mean to me. She was nice to you. She was mean to me. But I wouldn't have heard her any other way. I mean, I wouldn't have, it wouldn't have gotten my attention. I would have run right over you. She was a big blue meanie to me. You know, Randy and I wrote some inventory. We had to go out to Louisville, Kentucky to read that thing. And she played a cruel trick on us when we got there. She said, go sit in that room. I think you had to go to the bedroom first. And she sent somebody else in to hear our inventory. I mean, I about fell over. And then we had somebody else hear it. So we had to read this to other people before we got to read it to her. And then what I did read to her, she said I had a lot more to write, so I'm furiously writing still while we're there. I mean, it was just like, I hate AA. You know what I mean? But we did it. We did it. And the nice thing that happened to me there is I realized was that I was such a liar. I really am the actor. I really am afraid of what you think of me. And I have a certain, depending on what the situation is, I have a certain way that I want you to view me. If I don't like you, I'm going to be crazy on you so you'll stay away from me. If I like you, I'll be what you need me to be so you'll like me too. You know, just living for different types of approval from other people. And I was very, very angry, and I was very, very violent. If you pissed me off, I came after you physically, and I've had the cops called on me in sobriety because I was just so unmanageable internally. You know, when it talks about the bedevilments, it says can't control our emotional nature. That was me to a T. If I felt threatened enough, or I got angry enough, I mean, that stuff would just well up and I just would go nuts. And it got me into trouble a couple of times. I mean, it's not a good example of AA that you're living the life when the cops are called on you, you know? So I was really struggling with this anger stuff. And I'll tell you how I hit a bottom with that. But anyway, Camille helped me a great deal. I was 3.5 years sober before I really took a first step. Before I really understood what was wrong with me. When I really understood the true nature of alcoholism. As a result of that, I absolutely, as painful as it was, as tedious as it was, as much as I did not want to do it, I was propelled through the rest of the steps. And something happened in that submission. I accepted AA's way of life. I accepted that I had signed up for a life of service. I accepted it. And it was only because I finally got what was wrong with me. And I had finally conceded. And I found real hope in our answer. So, you know, it took me a while. And I hate to tell people this, but it took me a couple of years to come out of that dark place that I was in. It was really dark. And it took a lot of work. It took a lot of inventory. My God, we were inventory writing fools. At one point, though, I had to stop, you know, I stubbed my toe. Let me write a resentment. Because I started using that to try to manage myself. And Don said to me one time when we were in Colorado, he goes, Val, At some point, can't stay in inventory. You got to open up for business. Can't stay there. You know, but I'm the kind of person who, I love to navel gaze, you know. Ooh, I love things that satisfy the mind. I love delving into my psyche and let's figure it out. You know what I mean? I mean, I love that stuff. I love that self-centered crap. I love it. And, you know, at some point, though, I had to open up for business and get about the business of living and really practice in this way of life. I had a lot of old ideas about God that I had to get rid of. I really believed that God played favorites, that there were the have and the have-nots. And what I was looking at is how I felt at that time. That if there really was a God, God would change this. If God really loved me and if it was a kind and merciful God, God would change this. I would not be in this spot. I would be able to work. I would have money. I wouldn't have all my stuff in little green garbage bags. I mean, I've been like no car, no job, no money, nothing in sobriety. I mean, if there was a God that was nice, those things wouldn't have happened to me. It was a huge light bulb for me and a huge bitter pill to swallow to understand that I had made decisions based on self that placed me in that position. It was a revolutionary idea for me because I was so accustomed to it being everybody else's fault and that God must be doing this to me. Why is God doing this to me? And God wasn't doing nothing to me. I mean, you can't run around stealing, lying, stealing, doing other various things that we'd like to do and not expect to pay a price for it. And I was paying a price. It was a heavy one, but I was paying one. And, you know, it was just, Camille used to tell us all the time, too, you can take these actions and get the consequences of that, or you can keep doing it your way and get the consequences of that. It's one or the other. There is no middle of the road. It's one or the other for us. And, you know, I like to think there's a middle of the road because then I don't have to really do this crap. You know what I mean? Maybe I can skate off on it a little bit. But for someone like me, there is no middle of the road. It doesn't exist for me. I tried to live that way for a long time, and it got me nowhere. I was afraid of taking the third step because I thought God was going to ask me to go be a nun in South America and never have like money or sex again in my life. And, you know, I was told, well, if that's what happens, it's certainly better than what you got going on right now. So let's give it a shot. And so I couldn't argue with that. I could not argue with that. My life, I was page 52. My life was a disaster. Sober. I couldn't argue with that, so I said, okay. Started writing inventory and started getting to the truth about things, started getting to the truth about me, started experiencing a tremendous amount of forgiveness for other people while I was writing that inventory, which was, I couldn't believe that stuff showed up because I had people, some of my reservations about this AA program was, there are amends I will never, ever, ever make, ever. As a matter of fact, they owe me. There are some things I will never, ever, ever tell another human being. Ever. I will not pay back money. There were just things that I wasn't going to do. And those were my reservations. And, you know, I had to let those go. And then, you know, it was a shocker to me to be writing this inventory and start experiencing forgiveness for others. Because I never thought that was possible. And who would think that writing inventory would bring that about when I'm writing about where I'm wrong, would bring about such freedom? I had no idea. Did 6 and 7. I follow those directions to the T. I don't rob myself of nothing. I spend that hour, I ask those questions, and then I ask God to take it. I have been under the delusion that, you know, if I do it just right, do it perfectly, then I'm going to be struck perfect. You know, AA, God and guru and spiritual of all has not happened yet. But you know, it's one of those old ideas I like to play with. If I do it just right, then I'm going to be okay. You know, the thing is that I've gotten better. I have continued to get better as I've stayed on this path. and have been willing to do that stuff. I've had great experiences with 6 and 7. I recommend it highly. I do think the 12 and 12 is right when it says it separates the men from the boys. I think that's very true. Or the girls from women, whatever. It was changing for me. I owed a lot of money from stealing all those years. I think I was making $13,000 at the time, and I owed, I think at that time, what I could remember at that time, I owed like $40,000 or $50,000, and that was just what I could remember. When Camille had me start writing out all the stuff that I had stolen over the years, and I had to go all the way back. And, when I was sneaking into people's houses, I was stealing a lot of stuff. I was a waitress once. I stole a lot of credit cards. And, you know, I'd just check it every day to see if it had been reported. I had a lot of financial amends that I owed in to people I didn't even know, to places that weren't even in business anymore. And that's not even counting the people I did know that I stole from and took from and borrowed from. What she said to me, it was overwhelming to me. I think I was making $13,000. I could barely feed myself. And she said I had to start making these financial amends. And, she said, you took it out of the world. You got to put it back into the world. And she said, pick one. Follow the directions in the book. You pick one. And you call them up and you make the best arrangement that you can. You know, and our keen alcoholic mind is, I'm going to save up and do it all at once. I was not allowed to do that. And I'm so grateful. She had me start. And it was so humbling to write a $1 check, because that's all I could afford. And I had to do that. I mean, and this went on for a long period, but pretty soon I was able to make $5 payments, then $10, then I'm making $40, then $50, then $100, a couple hundred, then $1,000 checks getting the stuff paid off. And I can't even explain to you how that happened, except if I am willing, the ways and the means to clean up my past have always come to me. I don't know how that works. I mean, it's baffling to me. I just know if I'm willing, the ways and means showed up. And it was tough. Because, you know, it's mine. That's my money. I was reminded, because of good sponsorship, no, it's not your money. You need to give that back. I could tell you story after story after story of insanely remarkable spiritual ways that money got paid back. So it's just been an amazing journey for me. My life has been made whole just from the willingness to do this stuff. You know, when I started practicing 10, 11, and 12, I have had amazing experiences with step 11, stuff that I had no idea could happen for someone like me, experiences that someone like me could have internally. I didn't know that kind of thing even existed. I've been very lucky that I've been able to help women in my area. I have, you know, hated sponsorship at times, have loved it at times, have had my heart broken by it at times, have been ready to quit AA over it at times because it's damn ungrateful little whatever. I can't say the word from the podium. But anyway, I've been through all of that. And it is the thing that has healed me and put my life back together. It is the thing that has given me, for lack of a better word, my female cojones. You know what I'm saying? I'm absolutely comfortable with who I am. The wounds that I had, I hate to even use that word, wounds, but the things that I had within me that felt so broken and unhealable got healed by working with other women. That's how it got put back together. That's how it got healed. So it's been a remarkable journey for me. And I'm very grateful for my sobriety, and I'm very grateful to be here tonight. Thank you.